We're back talking to Sean Gourley, my good friend and an occasional podcast partner. You know, we do this once every few years. We talk about the world at large, look at the big themes. And I always enjoy these when I'm looking back at them after a few years. And we find out that, you know, the things we talked about kind of unfolded in a certain fashion. So I thought, now that you're visiting San Francisco again, maybe we should do this one more time. You know, this is the first time we've done this since the pandemic. I don't even know what to call it. Let's just call it a conversation about things we are interested in: data, machine learning, AI, and their implications.
That sounds good to me, and it's good to be back and do it in person. I mean, I'm over this whole remote work dynamic screens and that. It's better to be face to face. So, like, here's one for the real world. Yeah, it's good to be back.
Sure, here to that. Especially, you know, when you can get time with your friends.
Yeah, look, it's funny. Like, I always remember, think back as, like, you know, the Spanish flu, and you go back to 1917, right? Yeah. 19, and it's like, what mark did that leave historically? Like, we sort of collectively forgot about it. And, you know, we look back now and it's almost like we've sort of forgotten about this pandemic that we've been in as well. And it's funny, like, it's probably one of the biggest kind of disruptions to life that we will live through. And yet we sort of have forgotten that it sort of happened already. It's because there isn't really, like, any kind of tangible mark. There's a sense of loss, there's a sense of things, but what gets me is we're back in this world, we're back here, and yet we've lost something in the last 3 years of our lives.
You know, it's a funny thing you say that. I think we've gained something in the last 3 years. What we've gained is the next 10 years, we pulled the future in by 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, we lost tens of millions of people, you know, and I think we also lost trust in science. At the same time, we gained the ability to produce mRNA vaccines, which is incredible, and we gained an acceleration in technology. But, you know, it's like, wow, this is the future of working, right? It's like, you know, staring at screens and like, count me out. Right? Like, yeah, it might have accelerated it forward, but I'd be more than happy if that took longer to transition into that. So I don't know, maybe the dynamic here is that what we've experienced through this is a disruption to the status quo. And we started to explore different ways of being and interacting and working. And hopefully we can reflect on that and come back. Well, I hope we can. Yeah. We can reflect on that and come back and say, hey, these are the bits I liked. And these are the bits I didn't like.
Well, I think the whole pandemic was very sudden. The idea of hybrid work is what they're calling it now.
Yeah.
Wasn't really supposed to happen till, you know, 2030. And here we are. The technologies which were going to enable us to get to a hybrid, they're still half-baked. We got to the future much faster than some of the infrastructure. We have this whole idea, like, you know, a couple of weeks back, some WeWork filed for bankruptcy. And like in 2030, something like WeWork would be the norm, right? Because you probably don't need massive office space like the way we've had during the industrial age. Of the idea of an office where people go from 9 to 5 in a world which is completely connected makes no sense. But it also makes no sense for everybody to be working remotely. We were supposed to get there in 2030. We got there in 2020. And I think the whole thing was just like too sudden.
Yeah, I think that's right, right? And I remember myself and other CEOs and senior executives from the big, you know, the big fan companies, we'd sit around and talk and we'd be like, what's the right answer for work? How should we all do this? And we're all kind of sitting there and going, the fully remote thing doesn't really seem to work. And then everyone's like, yeah, I agree. But I don't know why. But then I think on the other side is like, how much work really got done in those offices anyway? And yet it's a sort of conundrum, right? Where it's like neither is quite right for where we're going. But I don't think anyone has a full answer. And we say hybrid, but I don't think we've really kind of fleshed out what that really means.
We need time for that, right?
Sure.
I think we were going to evolve into that future. And yet we got pulled in by the scruff of our neck, like saying, guys, you're here.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
Yeah.
And instead of dealing with it and taking that as an opportunity, many people are just saying, let's retreat back to what it was in 2019. And I think that's a lost opportunity. I think we got pushed forward and we could have, like, you know, the best we've done is Zoom, right? And I'm just like, no.
No.
But why are we like, just like, and now you suddenly see, okay, Zoom, but there's also like OpenAI and all these like new, like, you know, voice interfaces coming. It's like, well, hey, hang on a minute.
This would
be interesting.
And then I think the thing is here, I think we suffer from, like, the Valley does imagination of the future beautifully when it comes to technology. And I think maybe at some point we may have done imagination of how work could be. But it feels like we're lacking in kind of a real imagination of how we as a society choose to live in a world where technologies are just so substantively different than the world that we've come from. And I think what COVID did for us was it said, you can't do what you used to do. So that's out. Figure something else. And surely all the technologies that we're creating in artificial intelligence and everything else surrounding that is as transformational as a global impact of COVID. But yet it's not going to force us in the same way to say, stop doing what you were doing. Or at least I don't think it will. But the key bit on this is, like, we've got the freedom to imagine, you know, an organizational structure, whether it's work or personal lives or even society at large, that's fundamentally different to the world that we've been in. And the technology will enable things that haven't happened. But I think what's lacking from us is actually that imagination of, well, let's think of all the different ways this could be.
So just to make a finer point on what you just said, Silicon Valley is very good at imagining an abstracted idea of the future. Most of the people have read in science fiction, just to be clear.
That's right. I picked up a book. Yep.
And the second is Silicon Valley fails to figure out how to take their technology products and technology innovation and coexist with humans. I think there is a distinct lack of understanding in pretty much every single company, bar maybe one or two, like maybe Apple, because of its Steve Jobs influence. We have very little understanding of how technology dovetails with actual human beings.
And to draw an example on that, we did the equivalent of when TV was invented, you know, we stuck a camera at a stage play and said, this is TV. It's just a play on TV, right? Nothing's different. With work, we did the equivalent of, you used to have meetings, now you're having meetings on screens. Ta-da. And all we did with the new technology was translate the old paradigm straight into a screen. This is telling because founders, CEOs, you've got almost unlimited control of how you want to structure your organization, any which way you want. And yet the sum total of that imagination was repeat it, but do it in 2D instead of 3D.
Yeah.
And I think this really highlights is, like, if we were good at thinking about how humans and technology interact, we would have seen an explosion of different experiments of working. And yet I think we got same and kind of bland.
I'm not surprised at all. I mean, you know, not to pick on just one person, like, you know, we have this whole idea of, like, you know, popularized by, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, for example, this whole hustle culture, right? Like, you have to work 24/7 to get things done. And if you have any understanding of human beings, you also understand that beyond the 9 to 6 or 9 to 10 work, like, it's not 9 to 10 work day for most people. They have families, they have kids, they have to go home. Whereas that nuance of understanding that, like, there is a real life outside of work is something which was missing during the pandemic. It became pretty obvious. And that's why people wanted to go back to the office. It's like, at least, you know, I know what the work is defined and it's not in all intrusive all the time. And, like, people were expected to be available all the time during the pandemic. And I just felt like, instead of being more aware of the people's needs, most companies were distinctly unaware that they were actually causing stress to people who were working from home.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it? You think about where do things bend? And look, they're always going to bend towards economic incentives. And, you know, I think there was this space where in the first 12 months of the pandemic, where you had most of your social ties, your connections, your culture of your organization that you'd built up in person. And you're able to kind of trade that in during the first year for increased productivity, increased kind of things. And, you know, people were definitely working longer, but they were trading off of the back of all the investment that had been made and drawing that down. And then by the time you got into the second and the third years of that, people were going into debt. The culture, the organization, the knowledge of people, the camaraderie, the shared sense of mission and purpose, for the most part, I think had been kind of depleted. And so you end up in this place where, you know, I think people do get burnt out and you see a kind of a dissatisfaction coming through it. But I don't know. I mean, it's on us to imagine a different way of doing things, right? And we didn't imagine a different way. All we did was drew down on the accounts that we had.
But that's on us, right? Like, I think, and that's why we want to go back to 2019, is because this was an opportunity to redefine the workplace completely.
And by proxy, redefine the world that we're in. And I think we are in a place now where we are going to have to redefine the world that we're in, because the technologies that we've got coming with artificial intelligence are going to strip out, you know, you can run a number for, and I would buy anything from 20 to 70% of workforce, right? With AI, and you can draw a decade on that. And you know, maybe we'll take an under over on 25%, right? Of jobs today are gone by 2030, right? There's going to be a removal of jobs that is, I think, unprecedented since the agricultural revolution, the mechanization of agriculture. And in that space, we see the way that we as a society, the way that our economy functions, the reason people get up and go to work, changed as dramatically as COVID hitting our society. And so we've got that coming. And I think it's on us to be imaginative about how we want to construct the society post that. And I think the biggest danger on all this, people talk about dangers of AI and so on, like, you know, some people say it's going to, you know, turn paperclip factories and into kind of like robot overlords. I don't think so. But I think on the other side is we are going to see a massive disruption to the economic and social structures. And I think the danger is not that it's going to happen or that we won't see it happening. The danger is that we won't be imaginative enough to respond. And that, yes, is a danger, but it also, God, like, let's get around that, right? Let's start thinking.
Well, I think if COVID is any example, like, people are just going to do what is the most convenient thing.
Well, this is the thing, right? It's not the most convenient. You're going to bend towards the economic incentives, right? That tends to be like a good rule of thumb. It's like, where is the easy capital going to come? Where can you trade on the things that you've built, strip them down, and cash in all the different assets, so to speak, right? And that's going to be one of those. And that's short term, right? Like, you're going to go into debt, right? That's not a long-term strategy. You can't run a society that resembles anything like what we've got with 30% of the current workforce out of work. And I'll put myself in this camp. Like, I know it intuitively that 30% of work that we do today in a decade will be gone. But it just kind of seems like, well, you know, well, society will just kind of like get on with it. And then you look back and you think, well, when has this happened? Right. And you go back to 100 years ago in the agricultural revolution, the mechanization of that, you have 30% of the labor are working in agriculture, and that's now at 2% today. And you look at what happened around there, the Great Depression, you have a couple of world wars. That wasn't a happy time by all accounts, right? The great industrialization and mechanization of that and the changing social structures create, you know, for us, a world that I hope we never go back into. But if that's the closest historical precedent, we've got a very, very rough 20 years in front of us.
To play devil's advocate.
But you must.
So when I look at the world around me, and like I look at everything, you know, is being digitized at such rapid speed. The way I'm interacting with information and data is increasing at a rapid speed. And I see no option but to need something like an intelligent system to help augment my capabilities as a human being. And so I think of this as a necessary evil or necessity. Like, all automation can be viewed as evil or a necessity. Like we can,
and they're probably both.
Right? You can choose which way you look at a problem. And you're saying 30% of the workforce goes away. And yes, but does it not mean an opportunity for a new kind of a workforce to emerge?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
a certain class of people may not find employment.
You just don't remove 30% of a workforce from economic benefit into society in the space of 10 years and not have what I would contend is a disruption on the scale of what we saw from the late 1915 through to 1945, right? Like that period of time, I think is a good starting point. And like, it's on us to say, well, why will this change in technology and the removal of economic contributions of a third of the workforce be different this time than it was back then?
It would be different. Of course, it can be the same as well, because we actually have more institutions in place to kind of nullify some of the negative impact. We are more of a democratic society. It doesn't look like often, but you know, whether you look at China, whether you look at North America's, or you look at places like India or Europe, there is some kind of social structure to not have complete upheaval. In the past, if I know my history a little bit, at that time, there wasn't really that much.
There was a British Empire.
As a former
colonist. Yeah.
Yeah.
Colonies thereof. I mean, look, that had made their money off India. No questions about it. They were like, The economic output of India funded the British Empire by and large, and the British Empire sees kind of the rise of other societies taking on mechanization and says this is going to be a problem for our position in the world. The analogy that we're sitting today is like the US, right? We've had a global empire. It's a different kind of empire. But you're seeing the rise of artificial intelligence, and then the control of that technology, whether it's the US or it's China, is going to, you know, dictate the control of the economic structures and the militaristic structures that support them. And so we're in, I think, a space where not only is the technology changing, but it's also aligning with the mastery of that technology will anoint the global superpower of the world that we're moving into. So maybe there are some other structures in place, but like, faith in institutions, like as the sort of the answer for why we're not going to go down the same road we did, you know, 100 years ago. I don't know if I'm going to share the same optimism. I think we're in a worse position.
Hey, first, do not accuse me of being an optimist.
Yeah.
I take offense to that. Second, when I say like a little bit more faith in institutions, it's just we actually do have institutions. Like in the past, we never had this kind of a safety net. Like I'm just saying is like, it may not be like, you know, you're not falling from the 10th floor, right? To the, like, maybe it's like that.
We've got nation states this time, right? We didn't really, at the start of this journey last time, we didn't really have nation states to the same degree. But, you know, I think we are at that sort of scale, right? Where I think we have to look at history to say, well what are some historical precedents of this kind of disruption, right? And the disruption I would broadly categorize in twofold. One is economic. We will replace 30%. And look, someone could argue it's 20%, someone could argue it's 70%. But I think as a sort of a standard, 30% of our workforce replaced by artificial intelligence in a decade. So that's one. The second is, and it goes hand in hand with this, is dominance of artificial intelligence conferring an offset advantage militaristically to whoever masters it, right? Which means whoever has that technology with the upper hand will control global military power. And so these two kind of pieces hand in hand, you see, I think, direct analogies back to the, you know, the preceding kind of 5-10 years before the First World War, the mechanization of warfare and the mechanization of agriculture removing a third of the employment. And of course, there are benefits of mechanization. We wouldn't be able to feed 7 billion people without mechanizing that stuff. We wouldn't be able to kind of support a world without that kind of technology. And I think the same is true for artificial intelligence. But in the 20 years from which it exists today until it finds its kind of true form, I think we're in an incredibly bumpy ride that most of us, I think, are just blissfully unaware of.
When you say bumpy ride, what do you mean by that?
I will look, as a starting point, two world wars and a global depression.
Now, if we have a world war, we're just all toast.
Maybe, right? I mean, and look, you know, let's not diminish kind of the amount of deaths on the Somme in the First World War. Like, I mean, you have people doing, you know, charges over, you know, over trenches and straight into machine guns, and the numbers that were lost on that space. So we've been in that place. You go and look at the plaques at Oxford University and the colleges, and you see, you know, a class of 100 men, and you see 78 names that died, you know, that were no longer part of that class. And so I think annihilation is a possibility. I know I don't think the annihilation of the entire species, but you could imagine a world where the technology that we have creates death on the scale of the First World War. Absolutely.
I mean, that's also assuming that, you know, we have people who just will go on that path, right? Like, you just have to assume the worst case scenario.
Well, I think the thing here is we have to say, look, there's a reasonable baseline to this. Economic disruption and military advantage conferred by the same technology, right? And there is, you know, I think a data point. And I think we should look at it and say, why are we so confident that it's not that again, right? And I haven't heard a compelling argument to say, look, you know, it's really not the same as this. But I think it's on us to kind of look at that. I think the second bit is to say, well, how do we navigate this period of time, given that that is a possible outcome, right? And the two bits that goes to earlier discussions, so we need to get more creative about, well, what it means to kind of run a society where 30%+ of people that are working today no longer have jobs within a decade, right? And that we are well behind the eight ball on getting that done. So one is getting a lot more creative about that. And I think the second piece of this is, like, as a proud member of the Western Liberal Alliance of countries, like, losing that military dominance that we've enjoyed, I think would be a very, very bad place to be. And I have no interest in living in a world where the global military power that controls the space that we live in is China. So from my side, I think we have to win the AI arms race militaristically. And I think that gives us the best chance of not ending up in a conflict against China. And on the other side of that is we have to figure out ways to make society work where the economic structures that we live with today, a large number of them just are no longer done by humans.
What do you mean by that? So I have two questions, follow-up question, let's say. So are you asserting that AI is going to be very much like the nuclear atomic power?
I would say it's more like the internal combustion engine.
No. From a military standpoint, like in a way to create a status quo, but like the new Cold War is going to be the on AI.
Oh, well, I frame on the military side really in terms of this concept of offsets, right? An offset is a technological advantage that is so great that it renders the other side beaten before the game even starts. And, you know, there's examples. Nuclear weapon is one of them. Stealth weaponry is another. But for me, the most interesting one is going way back into the Portuguese expeditions into India. And you have Vasco da Gama coming around the southern coast of Africa and up, and he's got a ship with 30-odd guns on it. And he's able to take those guns and sit outside of the range, fire from the Indians, and basically lob cannonballs and defeat millions of people on an army. And you've got this kind of thing where it's like, if you have a technology that can fire cannonball miles, you can sit outside the range of another one and bombard, and you can take over like an entire standing army of millions. And for me, like, this is kind of the offset, right? It's like 200 people on a ship subjugating millions of people on land because they own a technology the other side doesn't have. And artificial intelligence is probably best thought of in that regard, is if you have AI that can outmaneuver your opponent, 200 people controlling that AI could defeat an army of millions.
So from that standpoint, I guess we have to make sure, when I say we, I'd say people in the US, that the other side doesn't get access to a lot of our technology. And here we are, you know, we have the NVIDIA CEO saying, I have no qualms doing business with China. I'm going to sell them my GPUs. You know, obviously he has to make money and make the shareholders happy and be the most important chip company in the planet, right? So he's not thinking about it from a national perspective. He's just thinking about it from a purely quarterly perspective. In that sense, our system works against us.
Yeah, look, we've been operating, and really since the Second World War, operating in Pax Americana, right? The American Empire, by any other name, controlling militaristically the entire globe. By all accounts, we could send a battle group anywhere, and it would project military power, and that was unquestioned. We're moving into a world where that's not going to be the case. And I think in doing that, it means like, well, all right, the usual kind of ways of doing business are going to start to change, right? And the CHIPS Act is kind of, I think, one pretty clear statement. It's like, no, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to sell anything below 5 nanometers into China. And that's done very clearly to say, we don't want China to have the AI advantage that comes with these kinds of chips. But there's going to be other ones, right? Which is going to be like, no, you can't do this with that country, or you can't do that. So there's a whole bunch of things that I think will come through. The technology stacks are going to diverge, right? Very clearly, like you're not going to run a technology stack controlled by your opponent in a coming global conflict, right? It's like, I've got a great technology stack, you know, all the chips that run it made by Americans. That's as silly as being like, I'm going to invade your country, but just please keep giving me oil to power my tanks. And like, well, no, the first thing I'm going to do as soon as you invade is stop your energy coming through. So access to chips, access to AI, and the ability to, you know, produce it is as kind of fundamental as access to oil was for the mechanization of warfare in the last century. So what's the natural outcome of that is a balkanization of the technology stacks. You're on the Chinese stack or you're on the American stack. But that takes time, right? And that'll take 10 years to kind of fully kind of disentangle. And I think if there's any sort of hope at the moment is that, you know, until that stuff's disentangled, it does seem very difficult for you know, China to be an aggressor in that dynamic. That being said, you know, as Athens and Sparta will teach us, like, if you think the other side is going to kind of be a problem in the future, better deal with them before they become a problem.
Yeah. Can we take a little step back and look
at... We'll take a step back from global war.
It's like, I mean, Dan, I haven't seen you in 3 years and you come back and just tell me the world's about to end. I don't know. I'm kind of worried about it now. I mean, I'm always worried about the world ending, but not that quickly.
Well, I mean, look, this stuff may happen sooner. Like, again, we know, like, that the technology now that we have, it gives a considerable advantage to whoever wields it militaristically. We know economically there's a whole bunch of stuff from medical to legal to accounting to coding to teaching to driving that these machines are doing that were previously jobs that were paying $75,000 to $150,000. And yes, it hasn't fully swept through that, but God, it's moving quickly. So we're seeing all of this stuff. And yet, and the obvious answer is like, this is going to change our world. And the closest historical precedent we've got is it's going to change it in a very bad way for the next 20 years. And yet, I think we sort of look at this and say, well, it couldn't get that bad. Right? No. It couldn't get that bad.
Well, it can't. I'm not saying that. I'm saying something very different. I'm just saying is that you're saying that this is imminent, and yeah. I'm saying that it might actually take a little bit longer.
So imminent for me would be a decade, right? In the next decade, right? And I think in this decade, you're going to see a whole bunch of stuff changing to be very unfamiliar, right? And the unfamiliar stuff that's going to come through are things like, oh, there are missiles going through apartment blocks in Kiev. You know, the US is no longer able to sail, you know, unimpeded anywhere on the globe without being attacked, right, as a naval. You know, yeah, there's protests from writers who are demanding AI doesn't steal their jobs, and that's turned, you know, it hasn't yet, but it turns violent, right? These are all kind of things that if you were writing the science fiction novel about this, these are things you might sort of like set your scene with. You look at this and you say, where does this lead? And I think it's pointing to us like very clearly as like, the world that we have lived in for the last 50 years is over, right? It's the end of the long peace. It's the end of the white collar knowledge work economy. It's the end, perhaps, of the meritocratic structures that have defined America. And we're moving into a space where it's different. And, you know, the conversation at the start is we've got some room to kind of determine what different looks like. But if we don't, I think we sail into a place that...
I think that is the bigger problem, right? I think we have a legal and judicial problem. I remember when we met like in 2008, 2009, we talked about the legal challenges of a data society.
Yeah.
Like there was no laws, there was no clarity
right.
as to like how, and you know, like fast forward to today, now that has manifested itself in like almost like a virus, like it's much bigger problem. We have legislators who don't even understand how email works on one end. Then on the other hand, we have the European legislators who just kind of let's regulate AI without actually understanding what this AI is all about or what it's doing. On the other side, is like we don't know what Chinese are doing. We do know that they are not giving a fuck.
Not when it comes to the military applications of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, they are giving a lot of thought into the censorship side of it and the information control and manipulation and, you know, that side of things. I think playing a very sophisticated game on that. And, you know, it's one, but we haven't really touched on is like, you know, one of the byproducts of this technology is really the control, very, very fine tooth control of what you consume, what you think, what you see and what you don't see. And, you know, that side of things may be a much more immediate impact and a much bigger piece of it. And, you know, whether it's military or politics, like, you know, it matters fundamentally that people have agreement.
Yeah.
And if people don't have agreement or you can manipulate them to bend towards your way of seeing the world, you ultimately have power and control of that society. And China wields its AI militaristically. We don't know all of those things. But what we do know is it wields its power inside of manipulation of information.
Yeah.
And look, I've been saying this for many years now, that look, TikTok, I think, will be regarded as the greatest intelligence operation of the last century. That China figured out a way to make use of our capitalist society to buy and then enhance and deploy technology that is responsible for the vast majority of all information consumed by everyone under the age of 40. Yeah. And, you know, we're seeing now, if all things being considered equal, if you've been exposed to high volumes of information from TikTok, you are much more likely to side with Hamas and the Palestinian side of the conflict in Israel. And China's going, we were able to do this. You let us control the information to your population. God, what stupid Americans. It's almost inconceivable that we would allow a world with geopolitical conflict with our greatest adversary to say, hey, you know what? All the information you want to give to our population, feel free to do it. And if you want to manipulate it, great, more power to you.
This is no different than when the Russians came and invested in.
Oh, it's not no different. It's done at a whole bit of scale. Russia was never an AI superpower. China absolutely is.
Well, they knew how to use propaganda better than anyone else.
The stuff that you're doing.
And the Chinese are doing it at a whole different
scale. Yeah, China got very good at this. I've been tracking China's work from the early days in Hong Kong on you know, misinformation and manipulation campaigns. They were amateurs at the start of this, and they've got very, very good. And part of the reason they've got very good is they control the platform through TikTok that the majority of Americans under the age of 40 get their information from. Can you imagine if we had, inside of Russia today, if we had the information that the majority of everyone under the age of 40 consumed on a daily basis, do you think they'd still be at war? Not a chance. Not a chance. And so that's what we've given to our opponents. We've given them access to control the information and thus the worldviews of the population of this country. And where that's going to manifest itself very, very clearly is China's going to make, whether it's blockades or it's ground invasion, probably blockades around Taiwan. And then all of a sudden, we're going to not care. We're going to not care. We're going to need stories delivered and we won't be able to agree as a population in America on what a response will be. And China gets, with no kinetic kind of impact, the full kind of production capabilities of the most advanced chip production in the world, and thus 92% of all the advanced AI chips. And again, if you can take Taiwan and you can do it without kinetic force, you get to control AI, which means you get to control the next economic revolution militaristically and economically. And you need to be able to do that with no kinetic impact, because of course, if you have a kinetic impact, you blow up the semiconductor factory. The way to do that is to convince America not to care. And the way to do that is to control the information through TikTok to every one of the population. So that is exactly the road we're going down. It's the AI war we talk about in the future. The first shots of the AI war are manipulation of the hearts and minds of the people, and it's happening today, and we don't even know. We're too busy with our, you know, well, you can't nationalize TikTok, or you can't ban China from that. It's like, at what cost?
I mean, they have not given
access. Of course, like, give us access. Let us buy, you know, the platform. WeChat. Yeah, let us buy WeChat, right? Like, no chance. Of course, so... Like, again, this is kind of like, you go back to your earlier points, it's like, well, where's the institutions in America that are kind of like looking out for this?
The thing is, like, it's like, you know, I hate to make it political. You have Biden / Trump, these versus somebody like Xi, who's like, he's like, you know.
Emperor. Let's call him emperor, right? And I think one of the ways to understand Xi is, you know, it's emperor, and what status of the emperor lineage of the 5,000-year history of that dynasty are you going to be? And I think one of the things there is to get to that next level, you've got to reunite Taiwan with the country, and that'll be the narrative of the CCP versus being the emperor that couldn't, right? And I think that gives us sort of, and you know, it's not surprising, that gives us sort of a time period of about 10 years with Xi kind of in power to kind of cement his legacy. He's got to do something to bring Taiwan back. And so I think it gives us a clock that starts ticking. And the question is not, is he going to make an attempt on that? The question is, are we as a country in America going to be in a place to actually agree upon a response?
I think this is the key thing is, like, you know, the world is a much more uncertain place right now. And, you know, I kind of laugh at when people say AI will kill us. And I said, no, we will kill us. I don't think AI will kill us by doing, you know, the AGI. We don't even have to get to that point. We're doing a fairly good job right now, whether it's climate change, whether it's like propaganda and mind control going through social platforms, and like the divisiveness of society, like, and just, and like all those things, you know, AI has very little role to play in that. It will only start to play a role going forward and making those problems even more acute.
You can certainly see a place where AI will create unintended consequences, or create damage, or create things. I don't believe for a moment that we're in this place where if we don't heavily regulate AI, it'll somehow kill us all. I think that's sort of doomerism on AI is not really even worth engaging with. I think the more immediate stuff is like, well, clearly militaries like exert power, and they do that through killing people, and you don't want to be on the wrong side of that. So if we're on the wrong side of AI global power, we will be killed, right? It's like whoever wields that power will exert that power against the weaker opponent, and the consequence of that is death and subjugation. Now, is like, oh, we all want to live in a peaceful society. And we have, as America is a global superpower and Pax Americana, we've had the period of the long peace. We have lived in a 70-year period of relative peace. The end of the long peace finished. And we will look back at that and say, wow, that world was different. We are now in a world of competing global superpowers that are fighting for dominance of this world. And whoever controls AI will control that conflict. So that is a very clear path to AI killing us, right? Which is whoever wields it militaristically will probably exert that from a killing perspective. And as whoever does this, we are seeing that stuff already unfolding today with AI in Ukraine. And if that war, and I think it will run another 12, 24 months, we're going to see more and more of that being part of you fight wars, you use AI. If you have a better AI, you win, right? So that's not even hypothetical, it's unfolding. So I think that's one way that AI kills it. I think the second way that you've got, you know, very clearly is you're going to just strip away, you know, all these jobs. And we say strip away jobs. It's like people that get up in the morning, that have a purpose in life, that are able to go to work, get paid, and provide for their kids. So you're not just stripping, you're stripping away their ability to participate in society. You're stripping away their sense of meaning and purpose that they've built their entire careers on. And it's not going to be like, oh, well, you know, this will happen over 30 years. It's like, this could happen, the speed at which the powers of economic forces, like, oh, that job you were doing, not profitable anymore. Machines do it better, cheaper, faster, right? You know, you jump in one of the driverless taxis around the city, and you look at this and say, how long have we got drivers driving taxis, right? And yes, there are some bumps in the regulation of the stuff and there's some pieces going through, but why are we going to have drivers? Of course we're not. It's like, why are we going to have a copywriter writing marketing copy for SEO? Of course we're not. Why are we going to have all of these jobs? And it's just like, you keep knocking them off. And that's what 30% of white collar work removal looks like. It means people no longer are economically participating in society, which creates, again, massive kind of like disruption challenges and ultimately, yes, death. So yes, AI will create scenarios where people die. It's just not going to be the paperclip factory getting smart and killing us all. That's just kind of fantasy land.
Well, can we turn a little bit towards a more optimistic standpoint?
Yeah, go on.
Of AI, which is like, I think when I look at it, the role it's playing in medicine, for example, is like cannot be understood. And like so much progress is being made, you know, synthetic materials being created, new vaccines, new experiments happening. I, you know, like we don't read about the impact of AI on the real science. And it's, I look at that and I just say, you know, there is something very hopeful. It's the same also the other side is, we need all those things if we want to maintain a status quo as without another superpower in the planet, right?
Yeah, my take would be in the short term, we're in a very volatile space and it's not clear where we end up. But if we get through that, right, the next 10 to 20 years, I think AI, like once we've gone through this disruption, is an incredible technology, you know, that we can replicate and human intelligence and scale it at a cost, you know, of effectively the electricity that goes into it, that we can deploy that for scientific discovery, that we can deploy it for creative exploration, that we can deploy it to help understand and analyze and perhaps solve some of the biggest problems that we have, like climate change and everything that goes around that. This is a tremendous technology. So the beauty of this is it can do amazing things for us. And I think if you were to ignore the disruption that it created to the geopolitical and economic structures of the world that we're in, I would be fully into kind of this optimism space. The reason I get pessimistic about it is that we're going to confront the disruption before, you know, we get to see the full kind of benefits of the technology through the other side. And the second bit of that is the ability to kind of like use AI to create and tell stories, to understand information, to explore, to critique, to debate. That's a very Western liberal view of this. Like imagine that same technology in an authoritarian Chinese CCP regime. A lot of that stuff doesn't make sense in that region. So again, like who is the global superpower and exerting their ideological influence on the world is going to color what AI can do. And I think when we imagine the optimism of AI, the prominence of the sciences, the creativity, the space of AI to create a new enlightenment with a technology that can do things with consciousness that we as humans are not yet able to do. We imagine that, of course we do, as though the Western liberal values are the ones that we live in. But you put that in the hands of the CCP and tell me that story still makes sense.
We have lessons to learn from social media, etc.
I mean, we do. And look, you know, like, you know, it's that piece, right? Again, we stripped out the institution of journalism,
yeah,
and we replaced it with the attention of people, you know, posting selfies, right? And what do we get? Well, Mark Zuckerberg got very rich. But what do we as a society get with this replacement of journalism with selfies, right? That's a terrible trade, a terrible trade. And we didn't know it at the time, right? We looked at this and said, hey, we're going to trade, you know, the institutional journalism for a set of selfies. But that's what we've got. And I think, what is that? It's like the technology can do many things, but it bends towards the economic imperative. And the economic imperative was, if I can capture your attention for as long as possible,
I can sell you an ad.
I can sell you an ad. If I can make you a little more depressed about your life, you'll spend more time here. So this kind of perverse kind of instantiation of the best camera technology, the best internet connectivity, the best, you know, scalability of platforms to connect billions of people, it becomes this kind of thing. Well, the economics say that if I can capture your attention, if I can make you addicted, if I can make you feel depressed, then you're gonna linger here and you're gonna be more economically valuable to me than if otherwise done. But of course the ARPU for users, like you know, circa 2015 when this is picking up, it's like $30 a user a year, right? It's nothing, right? We did all of that so that a company could make $30 a year off of us. And the cost of doing that was the removal of the institution of journalism to hold up the pillars of democracy. Terrible. Terrible.
Well, I think a lot of it, like I worked in the on the other side of the, you know, like I was in the media. I don't think Facebook did anything which media people were not doing to themselves. Right?
Well, the media probably would have, the media corporations may well have wanted to have done more of that themselves. But the point here is...
The point is that they didn't do anything. Like from the very beginning of the internet, they had multiple options to do...
Oh, it was theirs to defend.
Yes. And they basically let short-term thinking make all their decisions. When I started GigaOM, for me, the same technology, which probably now is called social, was blogging, was the granddaddy of social, basically was an opportunity to create my own media company.
Yes.
And I did that with a lot of optimism and hope. And over the years, almost 15 years, when I ran that website, it didn't fall prey to the base needs of like just ads. And you know, in the end, it went belly up, right?
So well, there might be a lesson in that. I'm not sure what that lesson is.
The lesson is that the society didn't want things to exist in a way they did. And they all, and as a very capitalistic society, we have very simple
metrics. Yep, and shareholder value.
And people, as a result of that, executives, human beings, society itself, is built around shortcuts. Always looking for hacks. Okay, I want some mental peace and mindfulness. Let me get an app for that. Yep. I want perfect body. Let me get Ozempic for that.
What can I buy? And I think the thing is these, in a world where everything bends towards the economic imperative, where do you want something to go? Well, just follow the money, right? The counter to that is follow the guns, right? Which you could argue that the money buys their money buys the guns. And so, you know, for both of those, follow the money. And if you're going to defend against that, you have to be very vigilant, right? And you have to dig in and you have to fight and you have to bring a lot of people with you. It's not enough just for yourself, right? You say, well, I'm going to fight the good fight. Well, no, everyone has to. And this is kind of, you know, it goes back to our conversation at the start, which is like, imagine a world and then defend the hell out of it when it comes under attack, because the values which you hold are going to be superseded by the economic incentives of the technology chasing those dollars. And we're in that place where we are gifted, like through science and hard work and the forces of the universe, the ability to manipulate electromagnetism to create human consciousness that can supersede us in many vectors of our intelligence. What a gift. What are we going to do with that? And we have to imagine it, but then we have to defend it, right? Because if in absence of staunch defending of that, we are going to end up with it doing exactly what we did with this beautiful technology of imagery and social and connectivity. Yeah. And we end up in that place. And it's I think, maybe it's less about are you pessimistic or optimistic, and it's like, what world do you want? What world do we want? And how much are we prepared to fight for that?
I mean, that's always been the case.
Oh, sure, you know. Right. But I think we've forgotten here, right? And the valley, you know, producing this AI, it got wound up on this thing. What if AI paperclips, you know, create a factory and kill us? At the same time, it's like we will never put AI into defense. Right. And we've been in this bubble where we've forgotten history, because for 70 years with America as the global superpower, we've lived in a period of I think historically unprecedented peace. It's made us worship at the altar of capitalism. And all we had to do was say, well, you know, this quarter, did we hit our numbers? Right. And that's everything there. And it's like the ideological things that we hold are second always to did we hit our numbers? And couple that with a bubble of San Francisco that manifested itself with, oh, we want to work on technology, but we'll never touch defense, right? Like the naivety of that ideological stance is if you could live in this world and divorce yourself from any kind of concept of military. That's what propagated here. And I think, you know, the Valley now, it's going to keep making great AI, like no doubt about it. But what that does to the world, like I think the path is pretty straightforward of where it goes, unless we start thinking about different kinds of worlds. And I think that gives me a bit of hope that all of a sudden you can say, well, how do we get people together to imagine a world and a structure and a space that's different? And I don't have the answers to all of that, but I think if we don't come up with some answers and then defend it, what we're going to get is going to look very much like what we ended up with 100 years ago, which was a very, very volatile and difficult 20, 30-year window.
Well, that was more intense than I thought.
Back to cricket. We're going to the cricket five-day test versus thing. Should they introduce the ball, the new ball, or should they let it come back with reverse swing? I mean, these are the questions.
You know what? More tangible things I can, you know, get my teeth around. Yeah. By the way, what are the games in New Zealand this summer, your summer?
You know, I don't know who we're playing down there. I rely on you to kind of like keep me up to date with that. you're the bigger New Zealand cricket fan than I am. I don't know. I mean, look, I hope to get down to the Hagley Oval and watch some of the things.
There is a direct flight from San Francisco.
There is. It is going out, the first direct flight from Christchurch, San Francisco. It's flying out on Friday this week, and I'm going to be on it. And I'm hoping they bring out those water cannons, because I've never had that where they put the water cannons on the plane when you land. It's going to make me feel pretty special.
I've never been to New Zealand, and then I just want to spend a little time when you're there.
It's a beautiful look. When everything I always say,
I'll come down there for a week and then fly out.
Yeah, come down. It's a short 13-hour flight and only 3 hours time difference. Yeah, so,
but you need to figure out all the nice food spots, and a little bit of photography, and then I'm going to go see my parents.
Yeah, fly back out through India.
Thanks for making out.
My pleasure.
Yeah, it was good to chat.
Thanks, Om.